How did we end up with these two candidates? How did we arrive at this moment in our politics and in our national history? I have a theory. And I don't know if you're going to like my theory. If you find something to disagree with about what I'm about to say, that's fine. I would love for you to call me. 504-267. You can do that. If you disagree, don't change the station. Change my mind. In the 1970s, a young man working as a media consultant in the Nixon administration saw the struggles that President Nixon had endured on television throughout his political career, and he wrote a memo to help turn things around. And the name of that memo was A Plan for Putting the GOP on TV News. And it charted a new way forward for the Nixon White House to adjust their media strategy to focus on mainly using television to shift narratives about what was happening in America in a way that was more favorable to the administration than whatever was left to chance with a more traditional media strategy. And the most iconic line from that memo is this: "Today, television news is watched more often than people read newspapers, than people listen to the radio, than people read or gather any other form of communication. And the reason is that people are lazy. With television, you just sit and watch and listen, and the thinking is done for you." That young media consultant that wrote that memo was Roger Ailes. By all accounts, a combative, take-no-prisoners visionary whose idea for fast-moving political news and analysis delivered by attractive people that viewers could relate to eventually became the foundation for a television network that would cater exclusively to conservative viewpoints and provide a friendly space for Republican officials and policymakers. Roger Ailes had this vision way back in the 70s. He just needed the money. Some number of years later, he found a funder when the head of a global media empire that had already found success with this formula, running sensationalist right-leaning media organizations in the UK and Australia, hired Roger Ailes to oversee his new foray into American cable television. And that man, of course, was Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes proved to be a powerful pair, and on October 7th, 1996, they launched Fox News to counter what they perceived to be a liberal bias in the media and to help Republicans get elected and to make lots of money. And they started this crusade at the exact moment that Newt Gingrich brought Republicans to power in the 1994 congressional midterms. Gingrich distributed his own memo called Language, A Key Mechanism of Control. In that memo, Gingrich told his fellow Republicans they needed to use emotionally charged words to describe Democrats, words like corrupt, pathetic, sick, and traitor, while describing Republicans in more positive terms like freedom, strength, and principle. This approach had only one goal: polarize the electorate and delegitimize the Democratic Party. Now, Newt Gingrich and Fox News are reading from the exact same playbook in this moment. No matter what the problem was, whether it was high crime or high taxes or unemployment or a foreign crisis, the message coming from Republicans and from conservative media was the same: blame Democrats. And not just blame Democrats because they were inept or corrupt, but blame Democrats because they hated America. They hated traditional families. They hated small business. They hated the military. They hated religion. That was the message that they repeated in Congress. That was the message they repeated on Fox News. That was the message repeated on the radio in tens of millions of homes, cars, trucks, offices, garages, construction sites, waiting rooms, gyms, and retail stores via the enormously popular Rush Limbaugh show. Every single grievance that you have, everything that is problematic or suboptimal in your life, is not only the fault of Democrats, but Democrats are creating these problems for you on purpose. Democrats hate America, and they are trying to crush you and your family and your business and your church. That is the message that has been the core of Republican orthodoxy for 30 years now. For my entire adult life, Republicans knew at the time that this message was effective at elevating conservatives in the media and getting base voters to the polls. But on Capitol Hill, it's a different story, because in order to govern in a divided government, you have to work across the aisle. You have to compromise sometimes. You have to speak out to the world as one voice, as America's voice, the voice of the United States of America. So even while you're beating the crap out of Democrats in public and impeaching Bill Clinton, you are still behind closed doors, in smoke-filled rooms in Washington and in state houses from coast to coast. You're passing spending bills, you're forging bipartisan legislation, you're treating Democrats like colleagues, like real people, and not like the monsters and traitors that you call them every time someone sticks a camera or a microphone in your face. I'm sure you can say whatever you want on TV, who cares? It's just dirty politics, right? At the end of the day, we're all pulling on the rope in the same direction. The things Republicans on TV and radio promised that they would do once Republican voters put them in office included things like overturning Roe versus Wade, balancing the budget, shrinking the federal government, passing term limits, passing immigration reform, privatizing Social Security and Medicare, pushing for religious values to be more visible in public life, including prayer in schools and the display of religious symbols in our government buildings. And there were incidental instances of success with some of these promises, but by and large, they were empty promises of the type that we have come to expect from politicians. They were lofty goals that the true puppet masters in the party never really expected to deliver on. And in the meanwhile, they typically got the thing that they were really after. Tax cuts. Tax cuts. The rest of the wish list was just that. Just wishes that would never go fulfilled, promises that would never be kept. But despite those promises not being kept year after year after year, the Democrats are monsters and traitors messaging was still incredibly effective at driving conservatives to the polls, so Republicans continued using it. After all, what does it matter to the average American if Republicans broke their campaign promises if the only alternative was this rogues gallery of elite, out-of-touch, big city, latte liberal, tax and spend, gun-grabbing baby killers? You can't have those folks running the show. Can't have them in office. So you got to go push the button for the Republican, any Republican, no matter how many times they burn you. Like Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown. During the George W. Bush years, an unnamed senior administration official, widely understood to be Karl Rove, told journalist Ron Suskind that the fact that Republicans kept lying to their voters and the fact that they kept not doing what they asked voters to put them in office to do, that didn't matter. He said, and I quote, "That's not the way the world really works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will act again. We will create other new realities which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We are history's actors. And you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." The George W. Bush administration under Karl Rove's leadership ended in abject failure with the most devastating economic crisis since the Great Depression, two grossly underplanned and mismanaged wars with no end in sight, and no better example of ineffective governance than the bungled federal response to Hurricane Katrina, a dereliction of duty and an embarrassment from which George Bush never recovered. George Bush did not repeal Roe versus Wade. He did not shrink the federal government. He did not privatize Social Security or Medicare, and he did not balance the budget. In fact, the budget surplus that was left to George Bush by Bill Clinton was erased before the end of Bush's first term, spent on what else? Tax cuts. The version of reality that Fox News cooked up to serve the Bush administration collapsed, and a new reality would have to be created. Now Barack Obama is in office, and the Democrats are on the cusp of realizing not only his major campaign promise, but a campaign promise Democrats have been running on for decades, health care reform. The Republican elite realize by now that the easiest and maybe the only way that they can stay in power, the only way that they can achieve that permanent Republican majority that Karl Rove had spoken about, was to continue to sweep their failures under the rug, to hide their deceitfulness and their untrustworthiness behind a curtain, and to double down on creating a new reality, just like Karl Rove said they would. And by now, Fox News is the most watched news channel in the country, ceaselessly frightening and titillating Americans, senior citizens in particular. And at the same time, a new ecosystem of online publications, social media influencers, and blogs offered a rich new terrain for conspiracy theories, baseless character attacks, and fake news to take root and spread like wildfire. And it was against this background that an authentic, independent, grassroots movement grew up. And then it was seized upon, commodified, repackaged by the Republican establishment elite, and sold back to Republican voters as something brand new: the Tea Party. In this new Tea Party reality, conservatives found an escape hatch from the political construct that they had bought into and that had disappointed them so badly and for so long. In the new Tea Party reality, the only people to blame for the failures of conservatism were people like George Bush and John McCain, because they weren't conservative enough. In the new Tea Party reality, it was the party elites who had it wrong, and the solution was to put on a tricorner hat, grab a Gadsden flag, and go hit the streets, blaming not just Democrats, but blaming both sides for the country's problems. Get some more independence in power. Break the corrupt two-party duopoly. It sounds good, right? It sounded great to voters, but it did not sound great to the DC establishment. And they fought back. The Republican elite had become incredibly adept at stoking the anger and disillusionment of American voters and then pointing that anger and disillusionment at Democrats. And the Tea Party, almost as soon as it began as an insurgent movement for independent voices, was captured and remodeled as an explicitly conservative movement that swept Republicans into power in Congress in 2010 with a colossal gain of 63 seats, with a tremendous amount of explicit support from who else? Fox News. Just 2 years later, in 2012, the Republican primary is mostly a race between Newt Gingrich, Ron Paul, Rick Santorum, and Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, who barely won the Republican nomination with only 52% of the vote. Mitt Romney, a bland, moderate former governor of Blue, Massachusetts, a multimillionaire private equity manager, and a member of the financial elite, if ever there was one. The first person who implemented the health insurance system that would later be called Obamacare. That's the guy that wins the Republican nomination. And he brings on Paul Ryan as his running mate. Paul Ryan, the budget hawk, the policy wonk, a member of the Republican Young Guns that were supposed to be the future of the party. But Tea Party Republicans, now more than ever, choking on a media diet of disinformation, anti-elitism, and unfounded paranoia, did not really want to show up for the moderate Romney-Ryan ticket. And up until the last possible second, Karl Rove, again, and Fox News promised them over and over again that they would win 2012 with this ticket and they would finally arrive in the conservative promised land. And when they did not, something snapped. The Tea Party movement, in its final configuration, was never designed to deliver the kind of sweeping change that its adherents believed was necessary, and it failed to deliver on its promises the same way George Bush did, because it was not designed to reorganize our government and end the Fed. It was designed to restore power and prestige to D.C. establishment Republicans after they had lost both. And it is at this moment that the nihilist, zero-sum, scorched-earth ideology that Newt Gingrich, Rush Limbaugh, and Bill O'Reilly built to destroy Democrats became something more sinister. Because now it's no longer under anyone's control. The Death Star that establishment Republicans built to destroy Democrats is now pointing in every direction, including at them. And now they have to rebrand yet again. The Tea Party alternate reality fell apart, and an even bigger alternate reality had to take its place. The faithful needed another escape hatch, a new movement that they could hitch their wagons to that would absolve them of the disappointments that had been foisted on them by men like Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Mitt Romney, John Kasich. And it is at this crucial moment that Donald Trump enters the scene. He's a political newcomer. He's a Washington outsider. And he found a niche telling Republicans some really uncomfortable truths about their party leadership. Things that conservatives had long suspected but often did not have the power to say out loud without serious consequences. Trump told Republicans that the Republican establishment failed to keep us safe on 9/11. Trump told Republicans the Iraq War was, quote, a big fat mistake. Trump told Republicans that the Republican establishment had sold America out by supporting free trade deals like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and he blamed them for their complicity in the hollowing out of American manufacturing and the declining fortunes and political power of middle-class Americans. Trump blasted the Republican establishment for failing to win the White House in 2008 and 2012, even as Fox News was promising their viewers it was in the bag. Trump blasted the Republican establishment for supporting comprehensive immigration reform when the base viewed that as amnesty. And again, he offered an alternative reality. As easy as it was for Trump to cut through the noise by telling those inconvenient truths, Trump had also already seen the ease with which he could cut through the noise by telling lies with no consequences. You want an example? Look no further than the birther movement. Why? Why did Trump become obsessed with the idea that Barack Obama wasn't born in America? It's not like he ever had any actual proof of that. Such proof didn't exist then, and it doesn't now. He became obsessed by that idea because he saw how easy it was to get people to believe it. And the more they believed it, the more Fox News invited him on to talk about it, which is really all he ever wanted, to be on TV and to be taken seriously by serious people. In the 2016 Republican primary, Trump catches fire, and it becomes clear that this particular brand of grievance-based populism is about to become rocket fuel for a large group of voters that had been lied to, exploited, ignored, and discarded by Washington, D.C.'s ruling class for decades. His promise to drain the swamp didn't just make sense to Republicans, it sounded damn good to a lot of Democrats and independents, too. Donald Trump won in 2016 with the support, yes, of the people that Hillary Clinton described as deplorables, but also with the support of a lot of moderate voters who were willing to overlook Trump's racism and his sexism and his bare-knuckle insult comedy campaign if it meant bringing real change to Washington, finally. In his first term, Donald Trump came to Washington with zero political experience, and out of necessity, he reached a sort of uneasy truce with the same establishment players that he had just spent the entire election attacking. His White House, his cabinet, was filled with experienced Washington insiders. His first chief of staff, Reince Priebus, was the quintessential Washington insider. His job was to maintain party unity by acting as a bridge between Trump and the Republican elite. His vice president, Mike Pence, was brought in even before Trump won to act as a bridge to solidify the administration's connections to the Christian right. Establishment figure James Mattis was his first Secretary of Defense. It was his job to act as a bridge between Trump and the military. John Kelly, Rex Tillerson, Gary Cohn, and others played similar roles in regard to their relationships to the nation's security apparatus, foreign affairs, and Wall Street, respectively. And all of those people, except Mike Pence, were eventually fired or resigned, and none of them are endorsing Donald Trump for a second term. And that is nowhere near a complete list. In 2020, after 4 years that could best be described as turbulent, and after almost no major policy successes except for the COVID-19 vaccine, and yet again, tax cuts, Trump lost his re-election bid. And as he had always done when he loses, Trump refused to admit defeat and instead claimed that the election was rigged against him. In his mind, there was no downside to doing this because now more than ever, he was an expert in telling his supporters the lies that they wanted to hear. And again, going back to the birther movement, he knew that he could get away with it and he could parlay those lies into electoral success. After Election Day in 2020, he tried everything. He tried pressuring state officials to alter the results. He tried encouraging fake electors to illegally submit alternate slates and then pardon them if they got criminally charged for it. He attempted to influence the Department of Justice to back up his baseless claims and lie to the public. He filed dozens of pointless lawsuits that were laughed out of court every single time, often by judges that he himself appointed. He encouraged state legislatures to illegally decertify election results. He pressured Vice President Pence to unconstitutionally reject certain states' electoral votes. And finally, and most dramatically, he sent a crowd to sack the United States Capitol on January 6th. Back to our friends at Fox News for just a moment. On election night, a man named Chris Steierwalt, he's the political editor at Fox, and in this role, he is responsible for overseeing the network's political coverage, including the decision-making processes for calling states on election night. And his decision to call Arizona for Joe Biden and severely narrowing Trump's path to victory went off like a bomb at Fox. Internal communications that we've seen show a company-wide freakout at every level. Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity absolutely flipped out in texts and emails in a state of near panic that the Arizona call was making them sworn enemies of Trump supporters. And it wasn't just ownership and opinion hosts. Even trusted newsman Brett Baier was revealed to have said that in order to maintain trust with their audience, Fox needed to take Arizona out of the Biden column and give it to Trump instead, even if that call was wrong and there was no other reason to do it. Chris Steierwalt was fired 2 months later. In the days and weeks following Biden's win, Fox News' most hardcore viewers very publicly started looking elsewhere for their fix, for anyone who could keep the hall of mirrors propped up. Newsmax and OAN were more than happy to take on that role, and Fox News had no other choice but to meet them there. And at this point, any remaining semblance that Fox News is a fair and balanced media organization merely acting as a counterweight to the less bombastic and sensationalist legacy media organizations is gone. Fox News is now taking orders from their viewers instead of the other way around in a way that is simply not true anywhere else. Fox News is not just a counterweight to the bias, inertia, and ineptitude of the other networks. Fox News is a virtual reality helmet with no off switch. And in the reality created by this machine, Trump wasn't responsible for the effort to overturn 2020. And if he was, it didn't matter. None of Trump's shortcomings as a person or as a president existed, or if they did exist, they didn't matter. None of Trump's criminal charges are based on anything except liberal media lies. And if they are based on something more real, they don't matter. And that is how we got to this moment in 2024. The only TV network that Trump supporters ever really trusted is now irreversibly yoked to deliver Trump supporters the reality they want to live in. Fox News has no choice anymore. They have no agency in the matter whatsoever, and Roger Ailes is dead. The captain is gone, and the crew is running the ship. And Fox News's influence on the rest of the conservative media ecosystem is so great that the gravitational pull of this alternate reality has convinced tens of millions of our fellow Americans that this tremendously flawed candidate, this one-term, twice-impeached, 34-time convicted felon, adjudicated rapist, this tormentor of our democracy is their only hope against the original monster, the Democrats, the sick, corrupt, pathetic Democrats who hate America and wake up every day dreaming about how to destroy us all. The most potent weapon Fox has left to boost Trump as a candidate and to keep their viewers happy is to make his opponent seem equally as bad. Both sides are bad. And that is how you get these two candidates. One who is untested and possibly unfit, and one who is tested and is demonstrably unfit. Fox News wants us to believe that these two candidates are the same. Fox News needs us to believe that these two candidates are the same, because in that binary choice, they think they know who you're going to pick. I'm going to close out with a quote from John F. Kennedy from 1963, which he used to encourage journalists and the public to question assumptions and approach unpleasant truths with an open mind and a willingness to reconsider perspectives. Quote, "You are obliged to tell our story in a truthful way. To tell it, as Oliver Cromwell said about his portrait, paint us with all our blemishes and warts, all those things about us that might not be so immediately attractive. We seek a free flow of information, and we are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values. For a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people." We'll be right back.